Radio.org. This is WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello. It's 10 o'clock.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Eddie Lundquist, Associate Editor of Manor, Inc. Manor, Inc. is the youth-driven, community-supported monthly newspaper published by the Livingston Manor Free Library. And today, we will be bringing you some of our stories. On today's show, how can we reconcile our differences? We'll have a dialogue between liberal and conservative teens about our current political divisions and how to bridge them. Winter Sager has a Sullivan County broadband update. Nadine Osborne speaks with the filmmakers of Last Gasp, who produced their film via Zoom during lockdown. Plus, my own conversation with county historian John Conway about the lives of hoggies on the Delaware Hudson Canal. That's all coming up on Radio Chatskill, Teen Edition. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Amy Held. Democrats in Congress are advancing President Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID relief package without Republicans. They're planning to use a procedure known as budget reconciliation to pass it with a simple majority. Still, NPR's Aisha Roscoe reports President Biden's plan to boost the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour does not now appear likely to get done.
President Biden says his proposal to raise the minimum wage will likely not survive in the Senate. He told CBS Evening News with Nora O'Donnell that he still believes that Congress should vote on an increase to be phased in over time.
I am prepared, as President of the United States, on a separate negotiation on minimum wage to work my way up from what it is now.
Biden also said he's not willing to negotiate on the amount of the $1,400 stimulus check included in the aid package. But he said he is willing to impose tighter limits on who receives the direct payments based on income. Aisha Roscoe, NPR News.
Northern California is getting ready to open what it hopes will become the state's largest vaccination site at the San Francisco 49ers football stadium. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports the country's most populous state with the most COVID cases is trying to reorganize a sluggish and much criticized vaccine rollout.
Santa Clara County public health officials working with the 49ers organization will turn Levi's Stadium into a mass vaccination site starting Tuesday. It'll focus on those age 65 and older, serving about 5,000 people a day at first. Santa Clara County Executive Dr. Jeff Smith says the goal is to ramp up quickly.
We have the ability to do 15,000 a day, but we obviously can't do that until we get sufficient vaccine.
Separately, FEMA and the Pentagon are helping to set up two other mass vaccination sites in California this month at Cal State LA and at the Oakland Coliseum. It's part of President Biden's goal to set up 100 mass vaccination centers within 1 month. Eric Westervelt, NPR News.
In Myanmar, thousands of people turned out today to protest this week's military coup. Michael Sullivan reports generals have ousted the democratically elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi.
Today's protest in the commercial capital Yangon was the biggest since Monday's military takeover and came as the military expanded its clampdown on social media that began with what the authorities called a temporary ban on Facebook shortly after the coup. Twitter and Instagram have now been added to the list, and residents of the former capital are now saying there's a near-total internet blackout as well.
Facebook says it is extremely concerned about orders to shut down internet access in Myanmar. The social media giant is urging authorities to unblock services. It's NPR News. The Fox Business Network has canceled Lou Dobbs' show. NPR's Giles Snyder reports it was announced after Dobbs was named in a $2.7 billion lawsuit against Fox.
Fox News says it telegraphed the cancellation of Lou Dobbs Tonight in October, saying it's part of a routine reworking of the program schedule following the November election. For the time being, Dobbs' show is being replaced by Fox Business Tonight. Lou Dobbs Tonight aired for the final time Friday night with a guest host in Dobbs' chair. Word of the cancellation, first reported by the Los Angeles Times, came after the voting machine maker Smartmatic filed a multi-billion dollar defamation lawsuit, accusing Fox, Dobbs, and two others, Maria Bartiromo and Jeanine Pirro, of falsely accusing it of helping rig the election that former President Trump lost. Fox News calls it a meritless lawsuit and says it will vigorously defend itself. Dreil Snyder, NPR News.
The Philadelphia Teachers Union has told elementary school teachers to stay home Monday due to COVID concerns. The union says school buildings are poorly ventilated and not safe. The district says teachers who don't show up will be subject to disciplinary action. Super Bowl 55 kicks off tomorrow in Tampa. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers play the Kansas City Chiefs before a record low audience capped at 25,000. Masks required in the pandemic. 30,000 cutouts will pad out the stands. The halftime show goes on but will also look different. The Weeknd is headlining the performance on a stage in the stands rather than on the field to limit contact with players and coaches. I'm Amy Held in Washington, and you're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the ECMC Foundation, working to improve post-secondary educational outcomes for underserved students through evidence-based innovation. Learn more at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Eddie Lundquist, Associate Editor of Manor, Inc. The new year kicked off with something that no American would have expected: a storming of the United States Capitol by radical supporters of Donald Trump. In mob-like fashion, these supporters vandalized and looted the building, and they did so during the certification of the 2020 presidential election. It was a violent method of spreading their erroneous message that the election was rigged and that the winner was Trump. The divide seen in the voters in the election is apparent across America, including young, future voters. To dig more into this gap and how the youth might find common ground, Manor, Inc. reached out to Livingston Manor Central high schoolers. The process of contacting and getting students on board was difficult, and it took quite a while, but sophomores Sienna Dutcher and Mackenzie Carlson offered to talk to each other and Manor, Inc.'s O.C. Helper and Demi Budd about their opposing views.
I will start with Sienna with the first question. Where would you define your, where, like, how would you define your political views?
Okay, I have everything written down, so I'm just going to read it off. So I would like to start out with how the two-party system is flawed. We are offered a choice between two lesser evils. Both Democrats and Republicans have deep-rooted histories of white supremacy, warmongering, homophobia, anti-Semitism, and an overall disdain for the lives of ordinary people in our country and abroad. Both parties represent the interests of the rich and uphold the worst about capitalism. I believe that the two-party system divides the country and blocks good discussions and debates. That being said, I identify with the term liberal slash left-leaning because there are many ideas that I agree with there.
All right, Mackenzie.
I'd say I'm a conservative.
All right. Next, I would like to ask who or like what most influenced your political views. And we can start off with Sienna.
All right. Well, growing up in the LGBTQ plus community and as a woman has definitely influenced my political opinion. It caused me to look into how some politicians were advocating and passing policies against my and others' well-being. And it made me realize that I had to hold politicians accountable and do some research before because my rights could be at stake. I found that if I didn't stand up for myself, no one would. And if you don't mind, I would like to provide an example of something that I had to look up for myself.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So in 2019, the Supreme Court was hearing cases about sexuality discrimination in the workplace. Some argue that Title VII includes sexuality, or at least should. And while others argue that Title VII doesn't include sexuality, discriminators shouldn't be punished. For reference, Title VII is a federal law that prohibits employment discrimination on the basis of sex, race, color, religion, and national origin. And the Trump administration filed an amicus brief, which is basically a legal document with the purpose of trying to persuade the court or add any additional information that will help the court come to a conclusion. This amicus brief argued against the addition of sexuality to Title VII, which would make it illegal to discriminate against people based on their sexuality in the workplace. This includes firing people based on their sexuality. If you're wondering, my sources on this are Time.com and NBCNews.com. In my own opinion, it is despicable and disgusting that the former president's administration would advocate against the LGBTQ plus community like that. Throughout Trump's term, his administration tried to pass anti-LGBTQ plus laws.
All right, Mackenzie, well, who or what have you found that most influenced your political views?
Definitely my dad and my dad's whole family. They're all like big Republicans and I grew up with them, obviously. So
I'm going to get into some a bit touchy subjects now. So we're going to first start off on the more liberal side. What are your views about the Black Lives Matter movement, including the riots? And we'll start off with Sienna.
All right. This is going to be quite long, so I apologize. But I am a firm supporter of the Black Lives Matter movement as a whole. Our justice system is deeply rooted in white supremacy, and that needs to change. According to the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Black men are 2.5 more times likely, more likely to be killed by police than white men, and Black women are 1.4 times more likely to be killed by police than white women. According to the U.S. Census in April of 2020, white people make up about 76% of the population, while Black people make up about 13%. Even though the Black people make up such a small percentage of the population, they're still getting killed more than twice as much. Over the years, we've seen many horrific cases of Black people being shot by police, and rarely do we see the police face any sort of fitting consequences. For example, the tragic case of Tamir Rice in 2014. Tamir Rice was a 12-year-old boy who was playing with a toy gun. Within 1 second of arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Tamir. Lohman and the other officer on the scene, Garback, were never charged or even penalized in the slightest for murdering this child. This is a theme that carries through many of these tragic stories. Other than the obvious police violence, there are so many inequities in today's society. According to the Commonwealth Fund, compared with white people, members of racial and ethnic minorities are less likely to receive preventative health services and often receive lower quality care. They also have worse health outcomes for certain conditions. Also, according to heart.org, Black women are 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than white women. Due to the racist values that started this country, racism can be found in every part of our government and society, and that's why people are marching in the streets and rioting. I don't believe that white people have a place to judge what happened at the Black Lives Matter riots. After years and years of protesting with no avail, I feel like all of us would be angry enough to burn down a building. I'm sure that there were a few people looting to capitalize on the opportunity, but that doesn't undermine the entire movement. The riots were an act of desperation and grief that I believe we need to respect. So many people in this country care more about the target than the hardships and inequalities that Black Americans face every day, and that is disgusting to me. The CEO of Target, Brian Cornell, has more than enough money to replace the Target, but the lives of the Black people killed by a racist justice system can never be replaced. I would also like to mention that the riots actually do help with progression of the law. This idea that rioting doesn't help anyone is absurd. Over the course of American history, rioting has been one of the only things that does work. The riots at Stonewall were a very important event in the gaining of gay rights. And even the founding of America was started by rioting.
All right, Mackenzie, you can go ahead and give your views.
I think that all lives matter, obviously. But I think if someone were to say that white lives matter, they would definitely be considered racist. So I don't think that you should put one specific race group in front of it all. And I think that peaceful protesting is fine. I don't think rioting and looting should be acceptable no matter like what the cause is.
Because of the severity of the subject that we're talking about, I'm going to give you guys each a chance to rebut on each other's ideas and have just like a bit of discussion.
Okay.
So Sienna, you can go ahead and give your thoughts on what Mackenzie has said.
So like she said, if white people said that white lives matter, it would be seen as racist. And I do agree with that statement, but because it is racist, because in the way that our society is set up, Black people are like super marginalized in every single way, as I like supported before. So the reason that I think Black Lives Matter is such an important phrase is because Black lives are not mattered by the government. As seen in Breonna Taylor's case, she was shot in her own home while sleeping. And the police that went into her home were only charged for the bullets that hit the wall of her neighbor's house. So in that case, it's shown that the justice system doesn't care about Breonna Taylor's life and how it was lost. They only care about the wall. And that's why we're saying that Black lives should matter. And I do agree with the statement that all lives matter, but I feel like it's taking away from the cause that we're trying to like portray here.
Okay, I agree with that, but I think that there's always like another side to the story that the media doesn't say.
Would you like to elaborate on that?
Okay, so I don't know the specifics, but there was like something with the George Floyd case that he was a criminal and he was already had charges pressed against him. So it wasn't like these officers just did this out of nowhere.
He did have some criminal charges, but I don't feel that warrants him being killed. He's still a man that deserves a chance to live. And the fact that the brutality that he faced for a possible check that wasn't valid, I just don't think holds up to what a white man would have to go through. If a white man did that, he wouldn't even have the police called on him. Even if he did have past charges, he wouldn't be killed. He might have been arrested. But that's my point on that.
Move on to the next question. This time I'll start with you, Mackenzie. What are your thoughts about the Capitol riots that recently went down?
I don't think what happened at the Capitol building was right. Like I said before, I don't think rioting and looting is like should have happened no matter what the cause is. But I think that Democrats are okay with all of this until the other side does it. And then it's like this huge deal. So
Sienna, you can go ahead.
I think that the causes for the looting with Black Lives Matter shouldn't be compared to the cause of what happened at the Capitol, because the Black Lives Matter movement, the riots were at a target and for the rights of Black people in America, while what happened at the Capitol was in a government building where something very sacred was going on for our democracy because some people were upset with the election results. I just don't feel like we can compare both of them like that.
You do have a good point, but I just think like that. Okay, so I think that if Trump got reelected and people were rioting against that at the Capitol building, like it was a reverse situation, then everyone would be fine with it.
I don't believe that it would have the same outcome as what happened, because if we were rioting against Trump, I feel like a lot of people would be shot and killed and hit with rubber bullets and tear gas and not let into the Capitol. I just feel like it's the two demographics on each side have such different positions in society that if the roles were switched, a lot of different things would have happened.
All right. But, well,
am I able to read my piece or does Mackenzie want to say something?
I'm good. You can go.
Okay. Sorry. I just wrote a lot of stuff, so I wanted to make sure I talk about it. What happened at the Capitol was egregious. It was a terrorist attack on our democratic system initiated by the speeches of Trump and his supporters. The hypocrisy shown that day is laughable if it wasn't such an awful tragedy. For a group of people who love America so much, chanting USA as you infiltrate the Capitol isn't really patriotic. And the same people who raided the Capitol believe that Blue Lives Matter just bludgeoned a cop to death with a fire extinguisher. This goes to show, at least for the people who infiltrated the Capitol, that the Blue Lives Matter movement for them was just a way to silence the Black Lives Matter movement. Speaking of the Black Lives Matter movement, according to CNN, on June 1st, 2020, 316 Black Lives Matter protesters were arrested. But on the day of the Capitol riots, when they came in with guns and bombs, only 61 people were arrested. When people were in the streets demanding that their lives matter to the guys of the government, they were met with brutality. But when white Trump supporters break into the Capitol, they were escorted down the stairs by police, and very little were arrested. One moment. Sadly, it is not a surprise that the police force continues to uphold white supremacy by allowing and encouraging white domestic terrorists to storm the Capitol. In my opinion, I wouldn't want to be associated with a man whose cult-like supporters storm our sacred government building. I just hope that everyone there that day gets the lawful consequences that they deserve And I hope that this tragedy gets the message across to everyone that white privilege is extremely evident in the eyes of the law.
All right, Mackenzie, if you have anything you want to say.
Okay, I don't agree with you saying that Blue Lives Matter was just a way to silence Black Lives Matter. I think it was for people to stand up for cops, because nowadays everyone presumes all cops as bad because a few did awful things. But I really don't think all cops are bad.
I believe that the cops themselves are not bad people, obviously, unless they murder people. But the ACAB movement was more of a way to say that the system was flawed and not that each individual cop was an awful person. And as we've seen, the system is definitely flawed, and that's what we're standing up for with that statement. I feel that the Blue Lives Matter movement, I understand that you want to stand up for cops, and I do believe that there are some good cops out there, but I don't believe that there's anything such as a blue life, because it's their job that they choose. Being a Black person in America is not something that you can choose, and it's not something that will go away.
I think that being a blue life takes a lot of courage to stand up for and protect citizens. So I don't know. I just think that, whatever, I'm done. I don't know what to say.
I agree that it does take a lot of courage. And I definitely, my heart goes out to people who do protect citizens. But there's just too many cops out there that don't protect everyone the same way, that I do believe that we need to have some reform there.
Okay.
All right. Sienna, you can start off with your thoughts on Trump's impeachment.
I'm very glad that Trump was impeached, and I'm not sad at all to see him leave. Over his four years as president, he only stood for the rich, straight white men, and I don't want to live in an America where I have to constantly demand that people who don't fit into those categories be valued. He's a dangerous man capable of mongering a lot of hate. He pushed judges and lawmakers to overturn Democratic election results, and he incited the violence we saw at the Capitol. This amount of hate and violence should not be in office, and he needs to be held accountable for his actions.
All right, Mackenzie, you can go.
I do agree that some of the stuff that he says is not the best. He's known for saying some awful things, but I believe that he did a lot of good for America. My parents' stock market and economy was great. And I don't think it's necessarily smart to impeach him. And if they want to impeach him so that he can't run in 2024, right? So if you're so positive that he lost this election, then what's the big deal? Isn't he just going to lose the next one too if he ran again?
I don't believe so, because he does have a lot of very supportive followers. And I'm glad for your parents and everything. But you guys are a white family who benefits off of having him in office. I do not benefit of having him in office. I actually almost got my right to be discriminated in the workplace. I almost got my rights to be discriminated in healthcare taken away during a pandemic. So if a trans person went into a hospital, they could be denied the rights because someone didn't believe that they were who they were. And I just think I can't stand for a man who does that to so many people in our country. But sure, he did a lot of good things for white privileged families, including mine, just not me.
I have a last question right here. Starting off with Sienna, what ideas do you have about how Americans could agree to disagree without treating each other like enemies?
As we've done in this discussion, I feel it's very important to listen to each other and to find common things that you do agree on instead of just focusing on what you don't agree on. Because not everyone's going to be persuaded by what you're going to say. And I feel like a lot of people need to understand that. I just put out the facts that affect my life and how everything's affecting me. And I put that up for people to see. And I feel like we all have to think about what the people on the other side are thinking in each moment
and how they got there, what their influences are, and then we can better understand each other and possibly become more unified, hopefully.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming here and having a nice, civilized discussion. It was really refreshing.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, it's really refreshing to see two people on the opposite side of the spectrum able to come here and have a nice, calm, collective discussion. I didn't have to mute anyone or anything like that or kick anybody, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I want to thank Mackenzie. Thank you for being very respectful. About
yes, everything. You too. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill Teen Edition. I'm Eddie Lundquist, Associate Editor of Manor, Inc. This spring we'll provide a new broadband service to Sullivan County. As previewed in the July 2020 edition of Manor, Inc., Sullivan County has embarked on an innovative project to bring 5G wireless high-speed internet access service to unserved areas of the county. Sullivan County Chief Technology Officer Lauren Green updated Manor, Inc. about the progress of the project.
The initial tower that the county funded as the pilot project, the Monticello Tower by the new jail facility, is well underway. Antennas were mounted on the tower the first week of December. Equipment enclosure has been installed. Some preliminary monitoring and management equipment has been installed in that enclosure. There's some final bits and pieces that we're working on there to get that up and running. It should be available for configuration and testing during the month of February. And by the end of March, we're hoping to be in a position where the LDC could broadcast if they so choose to do it beginning April 1st or some date thereafter. So the LDC has been created, and that's the kind of up to speed part of where we are with the first tower, Monticello. Second and third tower is one down on East Broadway on county landfill property and up in Liberty behind the Liberty complex. We've received from separate sources grant funding for those. They've been approved. We're waiting for initial paperwork to be completed so that we can begin design and construction phase on those two towers. And then there's a larger, for the larger backbone of the entire infrastructure, there's another grant application that went into the federal government last month. For the remaining 10 towers, waiting notification on whether that will be funded or not. That one's for just under $2.1 million. I think it's $2.075. It was $400,000 plus, I think it was $425,000 for the tower up in Liberty. The numbers are good. So we're somewhere in heading close to $2.75, $2.8 million in funding that we either have or are hopefully about to receive to progress this forward. Once funding is received, the plan is to start ordering equipment and getting engineering studies done and just start moving forward to get things up and running as quickly as possible. To anticipate that would be late 21, early 22 before all of that is installed, configured, and up and available. Time-consuming project. So this will be available for subscription service to the public. We're starting, as we bring towers up and online, we'll start offering service from those locations that those towers reach. The bottom line, just so that I can back up even a little bit further, the 13 towers that are included in this initial backbone project that's going to take shape in the next 12 to 18 months serves to cover approximately 65% of the county population. At that point, when this initial 10 powers is done, revenue from subscription services provided from the towers will be able to fund expansion to cover the remainder of the county. The ultimate goal and objective is obviously 100%, but we do have a charged anticipated coverage expectation of 80% by 2023, by the end of 2023. The intent and goal and objective is to have pricing that is at or below what Spectrum currently charges. But that, again, it's yet to be determined. But the goal and objective is to be less than.
We expect it to have a transforming effect on a good amount of Sullivan County at a time when it really is in demand. And we'll make the county a better place to live, to work, to learn, and also a more attractive place to come live, work, and learn. Because we still have room for a lot more people without spoiling our rural landscape. And what they bring to the county will be not just more wealth, but more diversity and more opportunity for the rest of us as well. So this is going to touch on so many important keystones for Sullivan County. And I've told Lauren this will be his legacy. This is what he is going to, I think, be very fondly remembered for, he and his crew, because this originated with them and now this LDC board. And it will be something that, whether or not it's explicitly acknowledged, people will be grateful for years to come.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill Teen Edition. I'm Eddie Lundquist, Associate Editor of Manor, Inc. The Delaware Hudson Canal is one of those things that means a lot in terms of the history of our area, yet only a few who continue to remember and recognize its importance. One of those people is John Conway, the Sullivan County historian, who, alongside his wife Deborah, is trying to preserve the history of the canal. Here's my own conversation with John Conway about the untold stories of the D&H Canal.
The canal was built, opened in 1828, and was built primarily to take anthracite coal from northeastern Pennsylvania to the Hudson River, where it could be transported down by barge to New York City and fueled the Industrial Revolution and a lot of the other burgeoning economy of the nation at the time. The coal was shipped on boats that were not propelled in any way, and they had to be towed. So the typical way of doing that was to tow the boats with a team of mules or horses. And most of the time, those mules or horses were led by children. They were called hoggies, and they guided the mules and the horses along the towpath, in addition to taking care of them from early morning to late at night. And especially as the canal era continued, these children became more and more prevalent on the canal. And as the years went by and it was more and more difficult to find male children because they were otherwise engaged in working, it became more common to see girls working on the canal. So these kids could be as young as 10 years old. And this is a story that has not been told really in any detail before. So this is an attempt to tell that story in the overall context of the canal and its impact on our region.
Who were the hoggies and what were their lives like?
So the hoggies were primarily children. They would be anywhere from 10 to 15 years of age. And oftentimes they were the sons or daughters of the canal boat captains, the owners of the canal boats. But in the absence of that, those canal boat owners or captains who didn't have children would have to hire these kids. But often in lieu of payment, they would just go to the foundling hospitals in New York City where orphans were placed, and many of these hospitals were over capacity. And again, we're in the early to mid 19th century. Canal operated from 1828 to 1898, and particularly after the major expansion of 1848, when the canal boats got larger and more numerous, we see more and more children becoming involved in the canal operations. And also as the years go by, we see more and more girls becoming involved. So the hoggies' responsibility, and by the way, the name hoggy comes from the common terms at the time for directing a horse or mule to go left or right. Ha and gi were the terms used for left and right. So the hoggies' responsibilities began early in the morning. They had to take the horses or mules, make sure they were fed, get them outfitted in their harnesses, and get them hitched to the tow mechanism to tow the boats. They were responsible for taking care of the horses or mules throughout the day and putting them away at night, so making sure they were brushed down or cleaned up and fed and whatnot, so that they could be ready for work the next morning. Their lives were pretty difficult, and oftentimes they would try to flee. So there was a great turnover. So more and more kids were involved in the operation, because oftentimes they didn't last very long working on the canal, because it was tough work, very long hours. What wasn't particularly strenuous work, I suppose, except for the fact that you were walking all of that distance. You know, the canal boats would probably travel about 3 miles an hour, and you were working as long as the daylight lasted in terms of walking, and then you were responsible for putting the team of horses or mules away. So it was a strenuous job, and it was a long day for these kids. And again, 10 to 15 years old, very common in the 19th century, I suppose, but still a story that's worth telling. And because the B&H Canal played such a role in the growth of the area, it not only made it possible to get goods in and out of the area for the first time, really, which sparked enormous growth. In the first 20 years of the canal's operation, the population of Sullivan County, for example, more than doubled. We went from about 12,000 people living here in the 1830 census, about when the canal opened up, to more than 25,000 by the 1850 census, 20 years later. It made possible the bluestone and the tanning industries, because it was possible to get the hides into the area, and it was possible to ship the leather out once it was tanned. And of course, this was in the days before the arrival of the railroads. Likewise with the bluestone industry. We were shipping tons and tons of bluestone to New York City. And in the early days, prior to the arrival of the Erie Railroad in 1848, all of that took place on the canal. So its economic advantage to Sullivan County was immeasurable, really. And the fact that these kids played such a major role in that, I think, is a story that needs to be told. So the CATE Project will tell the story of the D&H Canal, which has been told and continues to be told by the National Park Service here. They restored the Roebling's Delaware Aqueduct. It's told very well by the D&H Canal Museum in High Falls. But the story of the Hoggies, these kids, has never really been told. And that was really the impetus behind the CATE Project. So what we're doing is expanding that tow path that exists, that's still intact, just below the Delaware Aqueduct in Menasink Ford, and extending that about a half a mile to what is currently an Eagle Observation blind along the Delaware River. And along that half-mile stretch, we will locate some bluestone benches, creating some seating areas. We'll have some interpretive signage there to tell the story of the canal and the Hoggies. And we'll eventually hopefully have a bronze statue of a Carl Hoggy and the mule. That's the culmination, we hope, of the CATE Project.
What is the history and purpose of the Delaware nonprofit and the derivation of its name?
The Delaware Company was founded in the fall of 2012. It was named for the group of settlers who came to this area from Connecticut back in the middle part of the 18th century. They were a small group living in primarily in Preston, Connecticut at the time, and they wanted to own their own land. And farmland in particular was becoming very scarce in Connecticut at the time. And so they petitioned the colonial governor for permission to come west and to establish a community here. Connecticut at that time claimed ownership much of the land on both sides of the Delaware River. And in fact, that claim, which was part of the charter given to Connecticut by King Charles, eventually ended in a shooting war called the Pennamite Wars between the followers of William Penn in Pennsylvania, who claimed ownership up to the land on the western side of the Delaware, and the Yankees from Connecticut, who had settled there claiming the land as part of the colony of Connecticut. So at that time, there was a lot of tension in this area, as New York, New Jersey, some may be familiar with the Jersey claim line dispute, Pennsylvania and Connecticut all laid claims to the land here. But the Delaware Company was a small company that set up a settlement here around 1755 or so. By 1757, we had about 30 families living along the Delaware River on both sides, what today is New York and Pennsylvania sides, and spanning about 30 miles from present-day Lackawaxen, Pennsylvania, to about Calicoon, about a 30-mile distance. So the Delaware Company, the current nonprofit, took its name from that original group of settlers, and they established the first permanent European settlement in what would later become Sullivan County. The Delaware Company's stated mission is to promote and support the history and the historic landmarks of the Upper Delaware and beyond. We've, over the years, in the 8 years that we've been in existence, we've expanded our mission somewhat to go beyond the Upper Delaware and to take in a lot of the other areas of Sullivan County as well. But we're trying to focus on education, tell the story of those early settlers, but also any story of history, really, that that impacts local life. And we've been doing that now for a number of years. The Cape Project's a natural outgrowth of that.
Awesome. Thank you. Cheers.
You are listening to Radio Chatskill Teen Edition. I'm Eddie Lundquist, Associate Editor of Manor, Inc. Peggy Shaw and Lois Weaver are performers who have had over 40 years of experience in show business and were recently challenged to explore a new medium. The two are in their 70s and they're used to living in small New York City apartments, but they were developing a new show in London when COVID struck. They then made the responsible decision that instead of traveling and returning home, they ought to stay and adapt to their newly challenging circumstances. And the result is the film Last Gasp. Nadine Osborne spoke with Peggy Shaw and Lois Weaver.
One of my biggest questions is that, like, what were some of the constraints that COVID placed on you during the filmmaking process? Because there have to be a lot, in my estimation.
Well, truthfully, it enabled us to be just chill down and be in one place and make a movie. So what we did is someone gave us the house in London and we were there for 5 months and we just decided to make a Zoom movie. And wow. So we did. And now now it's online.
But it's interesting you said, you know, the constraints, because I think if it hadn't been for COVID and if it hadn't been for the lockdowns, we wouldn't have made the film.
Wow.
We would have done something else because we wrote a performance to be performed live and we would have done it live. But if we hadn't been locked down and in that room and, you know, and in that beautiful house that inspired us architecturally and visually, and we wanted to keep working on the performance while we were waiting for the lockdown, I don't think we would have made the movie. So in a way, it enabled us, as Peggy said.
I feel like definitely COVID is, while it's a detriment to some people, it can also provide an opportunity for like a lot of creativity. And I just think that's super cool. I just really admire the work that you guys have done. It's like thoroughly impressive. It's got to be difficult to like film in that format, but of course you said it was less so limiting and more of just like enabling, really.
Mostly our work is in, gets inspired by having, by not having a lot. I mean, we said, okay, we're in this Victorian house that nobody's touched in 50 years. Okay, what do we have? We have a Zoom, we have a computer with Zoom. We've got, people brought us a refrigerator. There was no refrigerator or store, you know, anything. So people brought us a refrigerator, the neighbors. All of a sudden, the whole neighborhood was involved in us being there. We had a backyard because we live in, mostly live in studio apartments in New York City. We were like in heaven having, what, it was three floors and like three bathrooms. And we each had our own room. And we each had a studio. And the backyard. I got obsessed about the backyard. It was, at one time, it was this giant rose garden. So it was like just wild roses everywhere and every, and everything. I don't know. Suddenly we had all this stuff and we decided to not bring anything in except what we could find.
One of our working processes is, this is what we've got. And that's how we work. We walk into a room when we're making a new show or we're making a new project, and we say, this is what we've got. And so that's exactly what we did. This is what, like Peggy said, this is what we had. We had this big house. We had Zoom. We had time. We had a show that we really wanted to get finished. And so we worked with what we had. But the other thing I think that really helped us is that our work has always been about the challenges that we're going through, whatever they might be. You know, whether it's about being women, whether it's about being lesbians in this culture, this country, whether it's about growing older and those kinds of challenges, or whether it's to do with how our community might be changing and maybe we're not changing as quickly as the community and keeping up. And so we make our work as a way to help us figure out how to meet these challenges. So in a way, it made sense for us to do that with Last Gasp.
I gotta ask, you know, you have this attitude of, here's what we've got. Have you found that since making Last Gasp, you've sort of been able to apply this to other aspects besides filmmaking?
We never made a film before. So it's kind of the opposite way around. We've only done performance. We don't do movies. So the reason the show is called Last Gasp is because it was going to be my last show. I'm tired. I'm 76. Lois is... How old are you?
71.
And I don't, it's too, I had a stroke a couple of years ago, and I don't want to, I can't memorize anymore. So every show we have to figure out ways for me to remember my lines. This Last Gasp was through my hearing aids, through my headphones.
That's clever.
So Lois would feed me the lines through the headphones, and I would, while I'm listening to them, I would say them. It was really good for my brain development. I don't know. Anyway,
that was a good example of working with what we had. I mean, we had to do that so that Peggy could have her lines. So I would give them to her, but then that became a subject in the film itself, where we were looking at Echo and Narcissus, for instance, the myth. And we were also looking at how people support each other in the work that they make and how sometimes that's gender identified. So the fact that I was ending up giving Peggy her lines became part of our, what we call our text, as well as part of our
relationship
and our strategy for making it work.
We've been in a relationship for 40 some years, and we've worked together the same amount of time, or a little more. So we don't know who we are most of the time. We don't know if we're performing or if we're just living.
So your to go back to your question, because that's the other thing, is we often go off on tangents, which is also how we make our work. We just follow the tangents. And we will let you ask some questions, I promise. But
keep talking. It's all really fascinating.
I forgot what I was. Nope, don't say anything, anybody. I know what I was going to say. Something about, I don't know, it's gone now. Anyway, it'll come back. Oh, I know. No, I do know. You ask if we've applied ourselves to more. We have applied ourselves to more filmmaking in the sense that we got very excited by this new Zoom possibility. And we loved the people that we collaborated on it with. And so we decided we wanted to keep that energy of collaboration going and work with the same limitations and see if we can make a new piece. So we are working on something new.
Between the two of you, who delegated the most responsibility with the film? Like, who was in charge and who was sort of on the sidelines? Or maybe it was a collaboration or...
Well, it was a collaboration. Our shows have always been collaborations, but Lois is the director. She is the one who makes the final decisions. And I have just brilliant ideas all the time.
In fact, she has too many brilliant ideas, so I'm also the editor. So I would say that we're pretty equal in terms of that. Peggy does a lot of writing. I edit it into something that looks like a monologue, and then she performs it, and then I direct that performance. And then together we come up with the concepts of how it will be done, but then I pay attention and hone that into a final piece, actually. So that's how we work together. But we also had now Nagai, who works with us who shot it on Zoom and edited it, and Viv Stoll, who did all of the sound and the wonderful music that you hear. And then we also had a choreographer, Morgan Thorson. So this project was really a collaboration and an equal collaboration between the five of us, even though Peggy and I had pretty much written and conceptualized the piece before we all got started. I think that is one of the most valuable relationships you can have, as a collaborative relationship, because more than anything else, you have to show up. And that's, I think, probably why we've made as much work as we have, so that we've managed to collaborate with each other all these years.
And I think what's kept us together is, in different ways over the years, it changes every decade or two, is this cabin. We're in this cabin. We've had this cabin since 1985, 86. Up
8. And, I'm also the historian, and she's the poet.
But we've had this place actually the same. We have the same stupid wood stove that doesn't quite work. We have, we've been up here a long time, but it's like having a space to be. Space is so important. And we're up here because we would be, after that big house in London for 5 months, someone drove us right up here. We couldn't, our apartments are so small. Now we have this secure cabin up here, and we have our secure apartments in the city. We're just so lucky, man.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's good to be like thankful and everything, because that's a skill that a lot of people need to practice. Also in writing, just being thankful for, like, not so much being frustrated with the process, but being thankful that you have the inspiration and the motivation to come up with ideas, and that you have somebody to collaborate with and enforce these ideas.
I heard someone say the other day that no one likes writing. We all like the idea of being a writer, and we have the desire, but no one actually likes sitting down and doing it.
I think just like, it's important to understand the ebb and flow of things, like of writing, of relationships, that if you're having a bad moment, it's not going to last as long as you put effort into improving it.
Yeah, good thinking.
Well, I think maybe that's our time for today. Thank you guys so much.
Wow.
This has been
great.
Congratulations on your newspaper.
Very nice interview. And sometimes we don't have such nice interviews with people who are a lot more experienced. So you did a great job.
Thank you so much.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Eddie Lundquist, Associate Editor of Manor Inc. This month I'm bringing you my latest page turners, in an in-depth look at H.P. Lovecraft's Call of Cthulhu and an analysis of cosmic horror. Cosmic horror is a difficult genre to explain. Most notably affected and composed of the writings of H.P. Lovecraft, it is incredibly complex and hard to pull off. It mainly utilizes scale and the fact that we are but a tiny, meaningless speck in a vast universe. A lot of times, the sort of punchline of the horror is the main character realizing the vastness of their universe and that they are not alone, or that there are things beyond their understanding at play. Lovecraft's work revolved around monsters, massive gods inhabiting our universe alongside us, unconcerned with our hopes, thoughts, and feelings. Many times the stories explain the main characters discovering these gods, leading to their minds failing and breaking, under the incredible knowledge that they had just discovered.
Dagon is a great example of that, and The Call of Cthulhu does an alright job displaying that. The Call of Cthulhu is probably Lovecraft's opus, and his most well-known and iconic short story, which has summoned thousands of fans to make video and tabletop games, music, artworks, and other stories with. I was extremely excited to read this short tale, especially after it had been so built up for me. It's only a few pages long and revolves around Francis Wayland Thurston, the story's narrator, as he uncovers the connections and happenings of Cthulhu, an ancient primordial god from the depths of space, who lies sleeping here on Earth waiting to be awakened by his cult. Francis searches for more information using different recountings and writing from various people, including one about how a band of innocent sailors accidentally woke up the mind-warping creature, releasing it onto them. The end of the story is Thurston realizing that he knows too much and could be a possible target from cultists or otherwise. To be honest, I was let down. I can understand why people like Call of Cthulhu, but it just really didn't fill my expectations or wishes. To me, Call of Cthulhu is a supporting story in Lovecraft's universe, a sort of taste test before fully submerging yourself in the madman's literature. In my opinion, what this suffers from, like a lot of Lovecraft's mythos, is the token disease, where there's extreme language and descriptions that would probably make the writing scarier or better without. It certainly gives his work his own recognizable energy, but I think it would be just as good about 4 pages and 10 brain cells shorter. It doesn't fully fit the cosmic horror genre for me, not exactly as well as perhaps Dagon, with its surreal beauty and horror, or Shadow over Innsmouth, with its continual inescapable terror. I think that if you want to read Lovecraft, read Call of Cthulhu first. Don't spoil your appetite with superior works beforehand. It's good, but it's not that good. 3 out of 5 stars. To parents, it's a bit strange, to say the least. I wouldn't say it's quite as nightmare-fueling as his other works, but more than anything, it's hard to get through, with some intense language and unnecessary explanations. On the positive side, it's a great source of creative inspiration and may spur a descent into a rabbit hole of pop culture and other literature.
That's all today for Radio Chatskill Teen Edition. Special thanks to David Dan, Art Steinhauer, Amy Hines, Taylor Jaffe, and everyone involved with Manor Inc. You can find more information about Manor Inc. at manorinc.org. Radio Chatskill Teen Edition is produced in partnership with WJFF. I'm Eddie Lundquist. Thank you for listening.
Support comes from Red Cottage, Inc., hand-picked vacation rentals located throughout the Catskills and Hudson Valley. RedCottageInc.com.
February 11th is International Guitar Day. Hi, I'm Angela Page, and on the next Book Plus, I'll be playing hot guitar players, including women, like this cut played by Lauren Sheehan, and 2 cuts by some real hot Canadian guitar-picking women, and songs about guitars. I hope you'll join me. That's Folk Plus following Wagon Load of Monkeys, Sunday at 4, or anytime on the archive.
On this week's On the Media, what to do about Fox News. The channel is doubling down on hate speech, disinformation, and denialism.
In the first 2 weeks after the election was called, Fox News undermined the results 774 separate times.
Deplatforming, unbundling, a boycott? Going in for defox on the next On the Media from WNYC.
Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Public radio for the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania. You're listening to Radio Catskill. Coming up next, it's Farm and Country, followed by Catskill Character, The Janice Adams Show, and Josh Fox, all locally produced here at your community radio station. Today's forecast, mostly sunny with a high near 30, increasing clouds tonight, low around 15, and snow mainly before 4 tomorrow. Highs near 30, new snow accumulations around 2 inches. Sunny on Monday, high near 24. Radio Catskill, keeping you connected.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello.
Your NPR station for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. We are Radio Catskill.
Your community radio station, keeping you connected. Radio Catskill.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.